Hey there, it's Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR. Before we get into the next episode, I wanted to ask that you subscribe to the show. It'll help us get even more unique and interesting guests on the podcast, and in turn, continue to educate management teams and the growing ecosystem that creates value for fast-growing private and public companies. And while you're at it, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating. Very much appreciated. This episode is brought to you by IEQ Capital, an investment advisory firm that provides a premier endowment-style investment approach and family office services to eligible clients tailored to the unique needs of your family. The founding team behind IEQ Capital are entrepreneurs at heart with an uncompromising focus on clients and investment excellence. With over 30 years' experience as investors, they have a broad understanding of each asset class, deep institutional relationships, and a network that provides assets to exclusive private investment opportunities. Visit www.ieqcapital.com to learn more.
While neither Tom Ryan nor the show receives fees from IEQ Capital in connection with the sponsorship, nor is Tom a client of IEQ Capital, ICR must note the potential conflict of interest in recommending IEQ Capital in light of our potential for a future business relationship. All statements in this episode express the speaker's respected personal views and do not reflect the opinions or review of IEQ Capital.
Build out loud. You know, when you build out loud, you give people an opportunity to know who you are before you meet them. And that might turn someone off, but who cares? If you turn those people off, they're not meant for you. But the people that don't get turned off, they're curious.
Standing out in an ocean of products is one of the biggest challenges there is, especially in the highly competitive food and beverage segment.
You can't buy customers anymore. They need to opt in. And the only way to get them to opt in is to make them feel something deeply inside that they want to give you their attention as a privilege for a brand to have someone's attention. And then you could sell them.
Being a public company can be hard. Small missteps can have outsized consequences. I'm Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR, and over the last 25 years, we've helped thousands of companies understand and navigate the stock market and the media. We'll demystify these and other increasingly complex stakeholder groups so you can focus on what you do best, building your company and unlocking your true potential. This is Welcome to the Arena from ICR. Introducing a new product into the very competitive snack market is not for the faint of heart. To succeed, you need more than a unique product. You need energy, creativity, and a bold approach. Today's guest has that and then some. We're sitting down with Jake Carls, who is the first to admit that he's a different kind of business leader, unapologetically authentic, refreshingly relatable, and completely free of bullshit. And I know that firsthand. Jake is the co-founder and chief rainmaker of Midday Squares, the good-for-you chocolate brand that turned a kitchen table dream into a global household name. Midday Squares is leading the disruption of an extremely competitive vertical with a winning team, innovative marketing, and a fearless spirit. Jake is recognized as a rising star in the business world, was a finalist for the EY's Entrepreneur of the Year Award, was named to Forbes 30 Under 30 list for food and beverage, and is featured as a regular contributor to media outlets across North America. He's also nicknamed the ICR Conference the House of Capital, and we love him for that. He's officially a FOICR, which stands for Friend of ICR. Let's enter the arena with Jake Carls.
Tom, baby, I love it. I wish people could see the video of what I look like right now. I look like a bumblebee. My hair's a mess. I look like I came off the streets, and that's who I am. And what I mean by that is I truly was always like a class clown, always the one having fun in life. You know, in high school, I was barely passing. I was actually one of the only kids not to graduate almost. And then my parents were upset. So I said, you know what? I'll figure it out. I'll graduate and I'll follow the societal path of like what society wants you to do. And I ended up studying business and I did okay. And then I tried to be an actuary. For those who don't know what that is, it's just deep math and stats. Opposite of who I am. Total respect to whoever has finished that and completed that. It's very hard. But it's just not who I am. And then, you know, I was faced with this great fork in the road in third year university that was, do I continue trying to be somebody else or do I finally let loose and see what I am. Who is Jay Carls and what do I actually want to do? Because till that day, I was just following the rules of other people in the sense of trying to impress others and try to be someone that fits in. And it was just not working. I was failing miserably. So I needed something else and I couldn't get a job. So basically, I got rejected by every Canadian bank at the time for an investment banking role or insurance company for actuarial roles. And I saw the show Shark Tank, and I'll never forget, it was on the TV, and this guy must have been, I don't know, 60, 65 years old, pitching his dream to the sharks. He looked so happy. He looked so free and so momentous. And I was like, this guy has everything to lose. He has two mortgages on his house. He has kids to feed. And I'm sitting on my parents' couch at 20 years old, 21 years old, with food on the table, thank God. And I'm crying like a baby because I don't have a job and I'm miserable. So in that moment, I said, fuck it. I said, I need to do whatever that guy's doing. I don't know what it is, but I need that freedom. And that's when I started my first business. And it was a fitness business. Failed in that. Well, I made some capital, but I failed in it in the end. I ended up closing it. And then I went to another business and I launched a party business across college campuses across Canada. It was really cool as a brand, but failed as an operator. And then I was 25 years old and my sister and brother-in-law came to me and said, yo, you are one of the greatest brand builders. We want to operate a business for you. You come in and be our partner and be the brand builder and build the relationships. That way you never have to touch operations again. All you got to do is make noise and you're great at it. Do you want to join our chocolate bar company? And I was like, you know what? My ex-girlfriend at the time broke up with me. I was depressed anyways. I was like, yeah, this is an opportunity to get my mind off a heartbreak. Everyone goes through heartbreak. They know the shitty feeling. So I did it. And we launched Midday Squares, the three of us, my sister, my brother-in-law, and I, in August of 2018. And the idea was build a better for you chocolate bar empire. And we're on our journey and we hope to continue building this empire. But at the time, you know what? I think the most important thing is that I'm being myself every day. And I've learned when you are yourself, you are your greatest superpower. And I learned that after 29 years of just trying.
Who's your favorite Shark Tank panelist? Mr. Wonderful because he's Canadian or someone else?
Yeah, no, I like Mr. Wonderful because he's out of his mind. That guy's like whack.
He's like mean.
He's completely whacked out of it. Yeah, forget about the mean part because I don't like that he's mean, but I like that he's just abnormal.
Yeah.
I really think he's himself. And I genuinely respect his unapologeticness. And I think that the difference between him and I is obviously he's a shark and I'm not. But I think one big difference is that I lead with an open heart. I'm unapologetically myself, but I just want to spread good vibes every day, be myself, and show people that you win by being you.
Totally. I'm an entrepreneur too. I started this company back in 1998, but it's really two steps forward, one step back. But you mentioned that you had a couple of tries at it, and I'm a firm believer in that. Very few people are like good at everything, like good at marketing, good at finance, good at like operations or whatever. It seems like you've kind of found a groove with your sister and your brother-in-law. Like, what's everybody's superpower? Like, what makes it work?
Yeah, you nailed the point. And, you know, first of all, failure in life is an opportunity to learn. And if you look at it like that, then it's always a win. I always said, if you input average decisions every day of your life, hence following the herd, being like everybody else, you're going to have statistically average output. Now, if you take that same graph and you actually input unaverage decisions every single day of your life, meaning you being you is unaverage because you have a different DNA than everybody else, then your output statistically will be unaverage, meaning you'll have outliers, good and bad, a zigzag output. At first sight, that looks hideous and everyone would choose the straight line over that. But then again, if you actually have a perspective of saying, hey, every failure or loss in quotations is actually a learning experience that I can get better from or not do again, then you're winning at all costs every day, every moment, every decision you make. So that's how I live my life. And that's why failure to me is just, it's another opportunity to win and get better. But, you know, skill sets. And I think superpowers and skill sets are what a lot of people miss the point on. A lot of people do things that they don't like doing and then they're good at it, but they're not their best at it because you can't be your best at it if you hate what you do. It's very hard to continue doing it forever. But what I say is to entrepreneurs out there or business leaders or people in any career that you're doing, find what you love. And if you're good at that, you're going to be really good at it. It's going to feel like a job, but at the end of the day, it's a job that you're living your best life in. I get to do what I love every day, but I'm still, it's hard. It's painful. It's a lot of adversity.
It's awful.
My brother-in-law is a software engineer. He's a data guy. He's running the ops in the business. So his skill set and his enjoyment in life is to actually go through data. He loves the process of data and playing with it and then making and executing on decision making through data. Then my sister is actually a badass executor and she loves manufacturing. So she built our manufacturing plant. Now, she really also loves being a creative. So slowly, she's actually going to move into the creative position. But at the beginning, she was dedicated to her dream of manufacturing and building products. So the three of us have really different skill sets. And when you put it together,
it's working.
It works, exactly. It's a puzzle that makes sense.
So we're going to get into like the product itself in a minute. But I wanted to ask you how you decided to put the whole journey of building the company out there on social media, because it's such a cool approach to like building a brand. You know, there's guys come out of Harvard Business School and like they work at Procter & Gamble and they have this like playbook that's totally set. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But what your gut is and what you guys are doing creates such a powerful connection, I think, with consumers, the good, the bad, and the ugly, showing vulnerability. I think you call it building out loud. Like, what does that mean to you? How did you decide to like, hey, we're doing this?
So I think the big difference is super fans and customers is the real thing. So what do we want? We want to build fans and super fans rather than just customers. And I think a lot of brands have focused on marketing to sell product rather than to build a base of a community or a base or a fandom. And for me, what that meant about building aloud was to use it as a vehicle to connect deeper to the customer. So, you know, we're in a very competitive space. Chocolate bars, protein bars, you name it. There's thousands, if not more than thousands of different products. Now, there's only limited amount of shelf space in a store. So you need to not only earn your space, or you could pay for it if you have all the money in the world, but it doesn't make a difference because people still need to buy your product. They need to buy into your vision and your brand. Today, more than ever, consumers in any industry, whether it's chocolate, plumbing, aviation, banking, they want some sort of emotional connection. But I think that at the end of the day, I said to my partners, the only way we have is if we use the phone, we use social media, which everyone seems to be on, why don't we insert our story into their day-to-day life where then they are entertained by us or educated by us and not sold by us? That being said, we don't talk about our chocolate bar 90% of the times. We talk about how we're building the business, things that relate to the human at a deeper level, very human connection. So we're talking about like things like therapy sessions, breakdowns, milestones, you know, huge problems we have, adversities. What that does is it actually takes you off your phone as you're scrolling and say, hold on, I want to pay attention to this because it relates to my life.
Because this guy's sitting in his front seat crying, like what's going on here?
Exactly.
Right?
Boom. Here's my thing. If you're building a consumable brand, you have no choice today, if you want to scale it really big, to have an emotional connection, because today, more than ever, the consumer is looking not only for product, function, and price, but they're actually added a fourth component, which is, am I a fan of this brand? Do I like this brand or not? And go to cosmetic world, go to Sephora. If you go to Sephora and you watch consumers, they're in there. They're talking about the brand. They're getting excited about the brand. They're taking pictures of it. That's part of their life. Today, that's passing into every industry almost. And if you're not on that, you're in trouble in the next 10 years. I'm telling you, a lot of brands are going to have a hard time winning, and you can't buy customers anymore. It doesn't work like that. They need to opt in. They need to want to opt into what you're doing. And the only way to get them to opt in is to make them feel something deeply inside that they want to give you their attention as a privilege for a brand to have someone's attention. And then you could sell them. But before that, you can't sell them.
Can you believe people spend money on billboards? It's like people are driving down the highway. Not only are they not looking at the billboard, they're not even looking at the road. Like they're on their phone, right? It's insane.
Yep. 15 years ago, billboards made sense. Radio, TV ads. And listen, if you want to do it, like we're eventually going to do a TV ad.
Of course.
But when you see us and you go to the store and you don't see a chocolate bar, you see, hey, I know Jake, Nick, Leslie, and the Midday Squares team. I either love them or I hate them. We've created an emotion and an attention thing that basically makes us stand out in the store across all 40 other thousand products. And I think that that's the future of marketing, transparency and storytelling. And I'm not saying you have to get involved in all this other stuff of the world. You don't need to do that. You just need to tell your story, whatever your brand story is and the true vision of the company and what's the core values. Yell it every day. Be proud of it, because that's what's going to set you apart, not the product. Everyone can copy your product more or less. Hershey's can figure out how to make Midday Squares down the line. That's not a problem. What they might not be able to copy is how we make our consumers feel. How we make them feel is what makes us different.
Totally. Talk about the original formulation and the idea. I know you've used the term mindful first functional chocolate bar. Talk about like the ingredients and who it appeals to.
Tom, great question. My sister and brother-in-law made this snack originally years ago, 3 years before Midday Squares, because they were making it as a chocolate bar for their afternoon, because all the chocolate bars in the market were just high in sugar. They were filler. There wasn't much to it.
Yeah.
And the protein bars were full of, like, you know, artificial ingredients, additives, preservatives, things that didn't necessarily agree with the stomach. So my sister said to my brother-in-law, let me make you something for your afternoon that will get you from that 2 p.m.er to that 5 p.m.er and you'll feel good. She was into the plant-based at the time. She was into all these foods. So she made him this homemade snack. And for 3 years, he took it to his office. They loved it. Then they decided to start a business together. And they're like, hey, there's data showing that dark chocolate's growing year over year and that vegan plant-based proteins are growing year over year. So my brother-in-law, being a data nerd, said, you're making a baby of these two massive growth categories. Let's launch this as the product. And they came to me and we launched the company. But why it's functional is because it's a dark chocolate bar. So you satisfy your cravings for indulgence. But the function is that it's got a little bit of protein and a little bit of fiber and high fat so that it fills you up as you eat it, but it doesn't make you feel bloated or, you know, nauseous or any of that jazz.
Or like falling asleep within 10 minutes after you eat it, right? Yeah, that's huge.
Yes. So one thing that we're proud of is it doesn't spike sugar. You know, we don't claim that because that's, you know, it's a whole other process. But the idea is a lot of people eat it and it doesn't spike their sugar levels, which is great because they could actually have an indulgence. But also be proud that they're getting their proteins and their fibers and their good fats in. So that's what we call functional chocolate bar. It's just, what would a modern day chocolate bar look like if one of those conglomerates started in 2024? It probably wouldn't be the products they create today. It'd be a lot different, kind of like looking at a Midday Square, more or less.
One of the many bold moves Jake and his partners made was their decision to build their own production facility. And I wanted to know more about that decision, how it came together, and the advantages it's given the company.
5 years ago, when we told people we were manufacturing, they looked at us and said, get out. And they laughed. And they said, this is the dumbest thing. Why would you not be asset light? Why don't you just go to co-packer? They could help you scale this business. And our response to them was, we tried. We went to 26 co-manufacturers that do the bars, chocolate bars and protein bars, and not one of them was able to replicate the bar that we made. They all wanted to change it, the ingredient deck, the process, because their machines were not made for the type of product we have. We have a double texture layer that we really like, a hard chocolate top with a soft brownie bottom, and they weren't able to make it. So they said to us, either you change the product and come to us and we can scale this business for you, or you go figure out how to buy your own machinery, make your own machines and build your own facility and spend a couple million bucks. And there's no guarantee it's going to work. So we took that option because we're crazy. And we started a negative 18 gross margin. Listen to this, negative 18%. And today I'm proud to say the last two quarters, we're at a 58% gross margin. And we're potentially going to get this thing to about a 65 to 70% gross margin. So at scale. So that's the advantage, is that we control our margin. When, you know, you go to competitors in the space, they're at 40, 44 at scale. They can't go further. Their co-mans can't go further. So all the hell we did was worth it in the end, because now not only do we control the innovation and we could actually build innovation because our machines can do different things. The second thing is that we're actually going to have a very great P&L and a business model at scale that's actually worthy, in my opinion, of either a sustainable long-term business or potentially selling the company, right? And I think that now we hear people talk from the investor side or the strategic side saying, hey, it's actually good that you manufacture yourself because you got your margin higher. You're getting a profitability way quicker. And I think we made the right decision in the end. However, it almost broke us 36 different times. We've cried ourselves to sleep. We see a therapist once a week minimum just because of the pain that we have to go through. So there's pros and cons. That being said, I don't shit on co-manufacturer business. I think they're great.
No, but you lose control. And listen, if you have a bunch of massive conglomerates out there that have tons of money and they're looking to stamp out every little competitor, it's kind of like, what could they be doing behind the scenes to screw with your co-packer potentially, right? Like, you control your own destiny with this, right?
Yeah. And every day I go back and I look at the factory and it's so cool. You see a bar go from nothing to something, you know, 70,000 bars a day go out, right? Up to 90,000. It's just fascinating.
You know, awesome.
5 years ago, we were doing 60 to 80 bars a day.
Yeah.
So big difference.
Very cool. Tell me about the best sellers.
Yeah. So we have a peanut butter SKU, which is basically our number one seller. Cookie dough is second. And the reason why they do so well is because they're healthy, nostalgic. So they're cleaner in ingredient deck, but they remind you of a different product, right? So we were able to create that nostalgia when the consumer has it. And because it's such a different product in terms of the textures, you really as a consumer are like, wow, this is so different. So we're playing with the mind because there's so much distrust from the consumer over the last 30, 40 years in terms of product creation. And when they try it, they're a little bit mind blown. So we get a lot of velocity and repeat purchase from our customers. That being said, we're still only in 7,800 stores. Our competitors are in 52,000. So we have a long way to go.
Yeah, it's exciting though. And speaking of retailers, what retailers do you sell through? Who are you most proud of? When you landed your first big deal, like who was that and what did you do to celebrate?
So we don't celebrate. I wish we did. I wish we celebrated. I think we're too in the game to celebrate, which I actually am sad about.
Yeah, you're in the zone.
Yeah. You know what? We got to get back to that. It creates momentum and energy. And I think we need to bring that back. So my next celebration, I promise I'll send you a video. But one of our largest partners actually is Target. Target has done a phenomenal job building midday squares up in the United States nationally. You know, we're in 1,700 of their stores. We move, you know, anywhere from, you know, 30 to 45,000 units a week. It's crazy. And they've been a great partner, two-way street with them, like in terms of two-way communication. Another great partner is Sprouts. Sprouts and Whole Foods have been great in the United States. We do very, very well there. High velocity, high SKU. Sometimes our peanut butter and cookie dough are number one and two in the entire category in terms of units per SKU per week sold. So the highest number of volume, actually, in terms of units moved. And in Canada, we have Walmart Canada, who's been a great partner. We have Sobeys, Metro, and Loblaws out here. And we're working on some big partners this year. Hopefully, I can announce them in the next couple of months. But two massive partners that would probably change the game of the company and bring us to the scale that we need to get to.
Yeah. So the product's refrigerated, right, Jake?
Yep.
Okay. So you walk into Whole Foods or Target or whatever, there's like a whole aisle. They got a bunch of chocolate bars. Like you're not there. How do you get people to find that? And I have to think your whole approach to marketing helps direct people there, right?
Yeah. So yeah, we are refrigerated. We don't have preservatives or additives. So the bar actually goes bad after 150 days in the fridge. You know, that's right off the press. But it could be enjoyed 5 days outside the fridge. Like if you're traveling, it's all good. No problem. You can have it out of the fridge. But the kicker to it is that we believe that the future of snacking is actually going to go towards refrigeration just because consumers want healthier items. They're starting to get cleaner and cleaner, and they still want indulgence. They don't want to give up indulgence, but they want the cleaner idea, and refrigeration means fresh, right? But the way we drive people is two reasons. Perfect Bar is a competitor of ours in a good way. Like we cheer them on. We're big fans of theirs, but they have built a phenomenal refrigerated snacking set over the last 20 years. So they've actually caved out a set in the stores to have a destination. And then there's been a lot of other brands that have come after. That's number one. So having a proper distribution channel where there's a destination is super important. So it's not a scavenger hunt at every store to find the product. The second is we use our online content and influencers to push a lot of people to the refrigerators. You know, just on our website, our store locator drives anywhere from 9,000 to 10,000 unique viewers per month on the store locator page. That's just on the store locator page. So that's over 100,000+ people a year looking for what retailer is holding our product and where it is in the store, right? And then on the top of that, we get, you know, 50, 60 million views on our social media. So that creates this awareness for them to go actually look for the product. Now, we definitely have a harder time on the supply chain side. It's not fully developed yet. You know, no one's really figured that out in the refrigerated snack set, but that doesn't mean you can't, right? So we're just bullish on it. And if you want to find us, go to the refrigerated section. Sometimes it's produce, sometimes it's in the dairy section, but you'll see it. Look for Perfect Bar and look for Midday Squares.
Yeah. You also sell direct off your website. How do you balance kind of retail and direct? How are those channels coexisting for you guys?
So we're 70% retail, 30% D2C, direct to consumer. We don't need more of direct to consumer. The average order size is a lot higher. So it's like $65 or $67, I think, for the average order, or maybe it's even higher.
Yeah.
But the idea is at retail, you can get one square at a time, right? So one unit at $2.49 typically. And what that means is we get a lot of trial through retail, but the idea is we find a lot of our loyal base stays online and buys consistently a lot of boxes for themselves. And we are a retail business, though. I think that that's what the most important is. The volumes from retail allow this business to succeed, right? It allows us to actually scale and make the manufacturing investment make sense that we put into it. Because this facility costed $4.1 million, and we're probably going to put another $6 to $7 million over the next 2-3 years into this facility to expand the line so we could scale to, you know, a really big scale. So yeah, we're a retail business. As of like, I don't know, 2 years ago, we were like 50-50. So it's been a big change.
Yeah, really cool. I have a question for you. I started this company from nothing. So did you. How do you want people to feel when they buy the product or think about it? That's like a big, heavy question. But like you're connecting with people. Like how do you want them to feel?
So I want them to feel three things. Number one, I want them to have a product that they could enjoy in the afternoon and feel good about. Like you said, not nauseous, not bloated, not tired. So that's number one, actually make their day better in their afternoon, a moment in their day. Second is when you buy Midday Squares or Into the Vision, you're buying into this boldness, this unapologeticness, this authenticity. And that's what we try to represent, is that we're a bold company. We don't follow the rules, the typical rules. We are unapologetically ourselves, and you either love us or you don't. And we're okay with that. And then third, we want you to believe you're supporting an underdog. And when you're supporting the underdog, you know, you're betting on us, you know, Michael Jordan and, you know, Nike. We want that. Or Tiger Woods when he's down.
It's powerful.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
People love an underdog, right?
It's human nature, right? Yeah. Dave versus Goliath. You know, everyone loves the underdog until you're not the underdog. And the idea is we can hope that Midday Squares' transparency and vulnerability allows us to remain as the underdog. And we're not competing against anybody. We're just trying to show that you could build a very large, large business by being unapologetically yourself with the product that you unapologetically created.
Yeah. The more you learn about business, the more you appreciate just trying to create a small little niche, let's say just 200 or 300 million, like, which is in the grand scheme of things, it's like nothing. It's so brutal.
CPG, and you know this, Tom, because you probably work with a bunch of people in consumer and you've seen it all around, especially food and beverage. It's so fucking hard. And I know people say every business is hard. They are. But it's really difficult to scale a consumer packaged good food and beverage company because the odds are tremendously stacked against you. The infrastructure is actually not favorable for you. And to build a brand today with the amount of content and information overload to the consumer, they've never had this much information in their face. It's almost impossible. Now, here's the kicker. If you create an innovative product that has product market fit, which you can, and then you figure out a way to be able to get the consumer's attention, you actually have a chance at winning. You have a very good chance. But to get attention today is almost impossible, like we discussed, and to build an innovative product is very, very difficult.
No, but like, you know what? It's almost a blessing that you kind of didn't know what you were doing, like on day one. You know what I'm saying? Like, because if you had all the information and you knew how hard it was and like all the MBAs came in and told you, you'd be like, all right, we're not doing it. You know?
100%. The naiveness has helped us tremendously. Yeah. And look, none of us came from food manufacturing, right? You know, if I were to do this again, I would not do it. And that's to be honest with you. It's so hard, Tom. Yeah. Like, there's pain daily, and every business has pain. And I love it. I'm not complaining, by the way. I'm privileged to be in this opportunity.
Of course.
But I have literally cried myself to sleep 36 nights. I have seen over 70 to 100 sessions of therapy per year. So every week, twice a week, potentially. I have been depressed. I have been lonely, misunderstood. And same with my partners. So the experience has been absolute hell. That being said, I wouldn't trade it for anything else. There's no gun to my head. But the freedom, the ability to have this freedom and to actually impact and make people feel something, there's no other feeling in the world like it. And that's why we love doing what we do every day and wake up. It's a choice. It's a fucking choice. Yes, we have investors and shareholders and all that stuff, and we want to return them the highest investment, and we want to make our consumers have the best product possible and our team to have the best outcomes possible. But at the end of the day, this is a choice.
Yeah.
And no one's forcing us, right? So we show up every day because we believe, and we really believe that the freedom to be unapologetically yourself is the most valuable asset you could have in the world.
Yeah. Plus, you think about how much you've learned since 2018, number one. And then number two, well, you've met a lot of really cool people. And like, it's all about the journey. You know, you're doing great along the way. Back to the product, Jake, what other like product extensions, like if you had a blank piece of paper and a lot of capital and things are humming like they are, what kind of products and product extensions do you think you can bring to market over the next few years?
So let's say the next 10 years, I just give that example.
Sure.
Right now we have the functional chocolate bar, which is the refrigerated double texture layer. We'll probably launch about 6 of them total. So we have 4 right now. We have 2 more coming, and then we'll do multi-format packs of that. Then we'd like to touch anything in chocolate. Chocolate's $100+ billion annually market cap. We want to play in the functional chocolate space, meaning that we could offer other types of chocolate snacks that have protein, fiber, and good fats. That's what we're trying to create. So whether it's a chocolate milk, potentially, let's just say, or a Dunkaroo, that's a renovated Dunkaroo. You know, there's so many cool options because chocolate is a moment in someone's day typically. And if you give them a moment that makes them feel even better about it, the world's your oyster. Now, that being said, how much time will that take? I don't know. We believe we can get this functional set to anywhere from $100 to $300 million in revenue over the next 7 to 10 years max. We like the idea of midday snacking or midday chocolate because, again, we're the midday afternoon snack, right? So we want to be known as that snack. We like that category.
How much capital have you guys raised? And I think, You know where to find your next round, Orlando, in January of 2025. How much have you raised, and has that been a big help for the company? Obviously, with the manufacturing facility it has, right?
Yeah, we raised about $17 million to date from venture. Great partners, Boulder Food Group and City Capital and some other ones. We also raised $4.1 in debt from our Quebec government to build the facility. And most of that money didn't go into marketing or expansion of sales, et cetera. It actually went into growth. It actually went into gross margin. It went into building our gross margin. Like I said, we started at negative 18.
Yeah.
We're now at 58, and we still got to go to 65, we believe, right? So all the capital actually went into juicing that, because once you have that, as you scale, you have money going to be printed back into the company, right? So it was all into that. We'll probably do likely one more raise that will be for growth, specifically for building out our media team and our sales execution model, right? And that will allow us to get to the goal we want to get to. But I don't know. Again, I think when you're raising money, to anyone that's listening to this, build out loud. You know, when you build out loud, you give people an opportunity to know who you are before you meet them.
Yeah.
And that might turn someone off, but who cares? If you turn those people off, they're not meant for you. But the people that don't get turned off, they're curious. They have a sense of FOMO. They want to get to know you. They're curious to know who you are. They already have a warm introduction without even knowing you. So when you actually go to communicate with them, it's not like, hey, Jake, pitch me, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yo, I love the video that you spoke about the recall.
Yeah.
You guys are so awesome. So it creates this human-to-human connection, even if it's the banking and the finance world, which is a very serious world. You actually loosen it up a little bit. You warm up the muscles. So I always say to people, build out loud. Don't be scared. Yes, your competitors might see something, but who the hell cares? Amazon didn't give a shit about their competitors on time. He focused on the best customer experience. And guess what he did? He built the best customer experience. A one-click buy. It's dominant, right? So we're the same way.
Midday Squares is the definition of a disruptor. They're up against behemoths in the industry, and they're ramping gross margins, executing at a high level, and making it all happen in such a unique way. Check them out at middaysquares.com. I want to thank Jake Carls for joining me today. We just love what he's doing with Midday Squares, and we're going to be rooting for him and them as they continue to grow. I can't wait to check in again down the road. This is Tom Ryan. We'll see you next time back in the arena.
References to specific stocks are not intended to be recommendations for specific trading behavior. Comments presented on this podcast are intended for informational and educational purposes only, and do not represent opinions or recommendations on whether to buy, sell, or hold shares of a particular stock. All investors are advised to conduct their own independent research into individual stocks before making a trading decision. In addition, investors are advised that past stock performance is no guarantee of future price performance.
This episode is brought to you by IEQ Capital, an investment advisory firm that provides a premier endowment-style investment approach and family office services to eligible clients tailored to the unique needs of your family. The founding team behind IEQ Capital are entrepreneurs at heart with an uncompromising focus on clients and investment excellence. With over 30 years' experience as investors, they have a broad understanding of each asset class, deep institutional relationships, and a network that provides assets to exclusive private investment opportunities. Visit www.ieqcapital.com to learn more.
While neither Tom Ryan nor the show receives fees from IEQ Capital in connection with the sponsorship, nor is Tom a client of IEQ Capital, ICR must note the potential conflict of interest in recommending IEQ Capital in light of our potential for a future business relationship. All statements in this episode express the speaker's respected personal views and do not reflect the opinions or review of IEQ Capital.